Today we're very fortunate to have with us Associate Professor the Hon. Dr. Ken Cogle. Now, he's going to speak about a very important topic to us all, and that is the education of our Members of Parliament as Members of Parliament. Because if you think about it, the profession of a Member of Parliament is one for which there's really no preparation. Anybody really can stand for Parliament, and provided you're over 18 and eligible to vote, and provided you don't fall foul of the constitutional grounds for disqualification, you know, like being in prison or bankrupt or holding an office of profit under the Crown, anybody can be elected as a Member of Parliament. And of course, once elected, we expect a huge amount of our Members of Parliament. We expect them to be better than us, cleverer than us, totally without flaw or stain. We expect them to be available 24/7 and to do a huge range of things. So how on earth can we prepare Members of Parliament to do that? Well, Ken has been working in this field for quite a few years now, looking at ways of training and developing Members of Parliament professionally. And there's no better person to do this, because Ken, of course, is a former member of the Legislative Assembly of Victoria and its Speaker, as well as a former minister. So he has an excellent background and, of course, years of academic study to inform what he's going to tell you today. So please welcome Ken Cogle to speak to us today about the education of our Members of Parliament. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation to speak today about this important area. I think I should perhaps commence, though, by explaining how my three careers, veterinary surgeon, politician and now public management scholar, can be reconciled. The explanation concerns which of these three occupations is the most responsible. You will recall that the Bible records that Eve was created out of Adam's rib. Now, that clearly was the responsibility of a surgeon. However, there was a bigger issue before Adam and Eve, and that was that order was created out of chaos, clearly a management responsibility. But the question remains, who was responsible for the chaos? That's where the politician in me comes out. This lecture will deal with three aspects of parliamentarian skills. Firstly, the functions of the parliamentary institution and what are the skills that are required for its execution. Secondly, how parliamentarians in fact acquire their skills as things stand. And finally, how should parliamentarians acquire their skills? Well, today's lecture is hosted by one of the world's most long-established and respected parliaments. And given Australia's role in parliamentary strengthening, it is fitting that the lecture takes an international perspective. Our parliaments, as we all know, spearhead governance in democracies. Efforts to strengthen parliaments made over the last decade or so by organisations including the Centre for Democratic Institutions based at ANU, the United Nations Development Programme and the World Bank Institute, accordingly, are not surprising. However, since parliamentarians, that is members of parliament and senators in our case, perform central yet unique functions affecting the effectiveness of parliaments, a considerable focus has been placed on ways of improving the knowledge, skills and abilities of parliamentarians. It's against this background that this lecture discusses recent research by my colleagues and I investigating how parliamentarians acquire their knowledge, skills and abilities for their parliamentary function and how parliamentarians could be assisted to better develop better fulfil their responsibilities and develop the skills they need to do it in relation to the Parliament. So the emphasis is on the implications for the functioning of the Parliament as the supreme political institution in our system of government. The study has concentrated on skills relevant to Parliament's functions rather than for the career of the individual parliamentarian. And it did not, for example, investigate campaign or other political skills. Well, the next question then is to try and answer the first point that I put on the screen, and that is the effectiveness of the Parliament, because it is, like virtually every social institution, dependent on the capabilities of members and senators to discharge their functions. It is then surprising to find so little said about these capabilities and how they are acquired. We can speculate that that is due to the greater interest of the media and the media's consumers, us by and large, in the contest of ideas and the struggles for power. The public's focus is on politics, not on Parliament. Scholarly journals are more likely to publish studies of Parliament, but even there, few report studies about the capabilities required for the functioning of the Parliament. So let's look a little more deeply at that. What are those capabilities? To answer that question, for me, it's an advantage to be a public management scholar in a department of management in a business faculty rather than a political scientist in an arts faculty. The public management scholar can easily collaborate with human resource scholars who do not find a place in arts faculties. Well, we do learn from human resource scholarship that capabilities can be classified as knowledge, skills, and abilities. Moreover, we learn that particular knowledge, skills, and abilities required by the individual reflect his or her functions and, in turn, the functions of the organisation, in our case, the House of Parliament. The functions and relationships of the Parliament within the democratic system clearly affect the effectiveness of national government in its capability to provide goods and services and to adapt to changes, whether those changes are internal, such as in the nation's demographic profile, or externally, such as its demand for exports of iron and coal. Now, we tend to think that everyone knows the functions of Parliament, knows what they are, but do they in fact? Most parliamentary scholars will take as their starting point Badgett's description of the British House of Commons as holding an elective, expressive, teaching, informing and legislative function. And these are taken as the starting point for defining Parliament's functions. Robert Hazel, from the Constitution Unit at University College in London, reports that there are seven classic functions of legislatures. These are representation, legislation, deliberation, scrutiny, budget setting, making and breaking government, and redress of grievances. Now, notwithstanding the different foci of individual parliaments, a number of common themes emerge from these definitions and descriptions. They relate to the three basic functions of representation, legislation, and oversight, with a further four functions, deliberation, budget setting, making and breaking governments, and redress of grievances, either being subordinated to one of the core functions or, in fact, combining them. So, in total, these then correspond to the seven functions identified by Robert Hazel and provide a convenient summary of the functions. Now, there are differences. Legislatures and executive presidencies differ in that they do not make or break government. That's done by the electorate in electing the president, and nor do they redress grievances. Well, let me describe the research that we've been involved in. It commenced with a pilot study of the induction for Australia's new senators in 2005 and expanded from that to a full-scale project spanning various national parliaments with different constitutional models and histories of democracy. These range from the Australian House of Representatives and the House of Commons at Westminster to the newest, the Timor-Leste Parlementary Nationale. So these are listed here, and I won't go through the details on it, but there is the paper available which has the detail giving this typology of the parliaments that we investigated. This particular slide is the one which we investigated by way of interviewing members of the legislature and senior officials and others involved in providing training. This second slide here is a list of surveyed parliaments. In other words, where there was a survey sent to members of parliament and to members of the parliamentary administration. This particular list here is those where we had responses from both. There were a small number of additional parliaments for which we had responses only from members of parliament. So one of the things that we then asked was about what the people interviewed thought were the functions of parliament. And we asked them to look at the seven functions which Hazel had identified. Now, we saw this as important because national parliaments are sovereign institutions. As such, their functions are self-defined within the constraints of their national constitution. So it follows from that that the perceptions of the members of that parliament are crucial to understanding the actual contemporary functions of that parliament. Parliamentarians and senior staff of the parliaments were asked specifically to rank those functions in order of importance as they saw them. Now, the research was interesting because it exposed considerable differences both in what interviewees see as the main functions of the parliament and in how they see the intertwining relationships between the seven classical functions, as illustrated by this slide here. And furthermore, as you can see, there are some strikingly different weights being given to particular parliamentary functions by parliamentarians and by parliamentary staff and others who are providing the training. And this is from people within the same, working at the same parliamentary chamber. It's interesting that parliamentarians rated representation much more highly than did training providers, whereas the latter rated scrutiny rather more highly than did parliamentarians. Now, at first glance, this rating of representation is consistent with Mises' view that, and I'm quoting, in virtually all countries, representatives devote a significant portion of their time to being present in their community and helping constituents with individual problems that they might be having with various branches of government. So that's one view, but representation can be seen as ambiguous. It could be providing the constituency services that Mises describes, or it could be deliberating in the parliament on matters of legislation or resolutions and voting on behalf of the constituents as their representative. However, when we look at these results, we can see that overall representation was rated differently and more highly than legislating or deliberately. So from that, I think we can conclude that generally the answers referred to constituency services. However, it is important to note that some did not see constituency services as the function of the parliament, but a matter for the presidential executive, as in Uruguay, for example. The low significance given to making or breaking governments is puzzling, especially in Australia and the United Kingdom in the current political circumstances, where the compositions of the government are a direct result of who can command majority support in the lower house. If either government lost the confidence of the house, that government would be broken. Now, these findings might suggest two things. Firstly, representation, legislating and scrutiny are the most important functions of the parliament and accordingly the functions for which appropriate skills are most important to the institution. Secondly, however, the low rating accorded making or breaking government may indicate a surprising blindness to a fundamental aspect of the operation of the constitution. The latter is not out of the question, having regard to Indra's finding of a poor understanding by Victorian parliamentarians of the function of the Auditor General's office and its relationship to the Parliament, that is, as the supreme audit body acting on behalf of the Parliament, as it is in Australia and many other but not all democracies. Now, at a minimum, that issue requires that the features of the constitutional context in which Parliament functions must be clarified for all newly elected and continuing members. Now, parliamentary functions must be discharged effectively and efficiently. For that to occur, its members, the parliamentarians, supported by parliamentary officers, must have the capacities to contribute effectively to that discharge of functions. But on that, there is a range of perspectives on the appropriateness of training for parliamentarians. Some argue that the capacities with which a parliamentarian enters Parliament are those on which he or she had been elected. To alter those could be to interfere with democratic representation. That's one view. Others view training as appropriate, if limited, to processes and practical aspects of legislating. Yet others have few reservations about any limitation on training, including negotiation or other political management techniques. There are differences as to whether the political skills are best provided by Parliament, political parties, or others in each of these cases. There are also some distinct cultural differences pertaining to what is acceptable ethically. For example, many have no difficulty with representation of particular constituent issues, as generally is the case in Australia, for example, assistance with public housing. But in Uruguay, such assistance to an individual is to confer an unfair advantage to that individual. Different way of looking at things. So these considerations highlight the importance of clarifying the context and the objectives of training. If I can revert to management speak from my workplace, the parliamentarians are the organisation's principal human resources, and the development of their knowledge, skills and abilities is human resource development. Human resource development necessarily involves adult learning as distinct from children's development and education. Now, much is known about human resource development in business and in the public sector, but there is very little concerning parliamentarians published before our work. So let me turn now to how parliamentarians acquire their skills. Adult education and training theorists have established that adults, including parliamentarians by implication, can enhance their knowledge, skills and abilities when exposed to adult learning techniques in organisations, and this in turn improves the effectiveness of organisational performance. Importantly, studies from human resource development can help in understanding how training can impact parliamentarians. This is despite significant difference between parliamentary and other careers, including different recruitment processes, if I can term election in that way, potentially short careers, party discipline, and the unique institution in which they work, the Parliament. Newly acquired knowledge, skills and abilities induced by experiential forms of training programs can potentially improve performance to the benefit of the Parliament, political parties and individual parliamentarians' re-election prospects, perhaps. This leads us then to consider what types of programs are offered to newly elected and continuing parliamentarians. So the sources for the design and delivery of programs offered to parliamentarians do vary significantly, and this is related to how established a parliamentary democracy is in a particular country. Indeed, in well-established parliaments such as Australia, Canada and the United Kingdom, there is a wide range of training providers from which Parliament and parliamentarians can choose to receive training. These normally span three common sources. The first of those sources is in-house training programs provided by parliamentary staff, sometimes augmented by external providers. These providers can usually focus in delivering orientation and induction to new parliamentarians. If I can briefly describe the training offered in the Senate and the House of Representatives. It is, in fact, significantly different. In 2005, the new senators had been elected several months in advance of their terms, which began on the 1st of July, and ample time was available between that date and the first sitting. So the Senate induction program in that particular intake had an unusually large number of new senators, including one former member of the House of Representatives. In that case, the program extended over 4 days and was well attended. It did incorporate adult learning techniques, including a form of experiential learning, a mock sitting. Now, officers of the Senate tell me that since mock sittings were first included in induction programs, newly elected senators have settled in much more quickly than previously. The 2010 House of Representatives program was held over 1.5 days, as is customary. House of Representatives staff indicate to me that this is the maximum period which newly elected members of the House of Representatives can make available in the context of the short time between the declaration of the polls and the sittings commencing and the demands on them during that very limited time. That particular program did not include any mock sitting. In the United Kingdom, following the 2010 elections, an extensive range of professional development programs were offered to the 232, about one-third, newly elected members of the House of Commons. The programs were offered by a wide range of organisations, including the Hansard Society. They were offered by a range of organisations. Another one is the Institute for Governance, set up by a charitable trust in UK. The proportion of parliamentarians who participated appears to have been quite small, however, estimated at 19% of the new parliamentarians. The second source of programs offered in well-established parliaments is from political parties. Loyalty to political party means that party member parliamentarians are likely to accept requests to participate in training which the party organises. They provide workshops and mentoring programs to their candidates and parliamentarians so as to maximise their effectiveness as party member parliamentarians. A Canadian parliamentarian, for example, from one of the Conservative parties in Canada stated that his party had been providing hour-long Monday night experiential programs to its caucus members, coupled with one-on-one mentoring among parliamentarians. Party whips in particular play a central function in organising and providing these various forms of training to caucus members in established parliaments. Indeed, according to one Australian parliamentarian interviewed, whips provide a popular and practical source of training to parliamentarians. They do, for example, he said, do so by assigning motions to MPs to raise in the Parliament and advice on when and how to do so. They also provide parliamentarians with a common line of argument a party has adopted concerning a particular policy issue should parliamentarians get questioned by the media at a doorstep, for example. These party-sourced training programs are normally well-regarded and attract maximum attendance as parliamentarians tend to strictly adhere to party-organised events. The third common source of training in established parliaments is the parliamentary library. This source is valuable particularly to parliamentarians who opt to engage in self-learning techniques. In this case, the only involvement of parliamentary staff is in terms of directing parliamentarians on how and where to get relevant information to enhance their learning experience. Now, our data shows that this source of training is mainly accessed by senior parliamentarians who want to supplement their knowledge, skills and abilities with up-to-date information. But again, Canada provides another interesting example. Members of the House of Commons there hire experienced staff to act as what they term both enablers and trainers. As a result, such staff usually attend training programs with a view to, in turn, training their parliamentarians. As one parliamentarian put it, I have got 3 full-time staff in my constituency office. I learn through them. Now, these sentiments were echoed by another Canadian parliamentarian who pointed out that whenever he hears of some good training program around the world, he sends his trusted staff because he gets the best training from this trusted staff. I imagine the trusted staff look for opportunities with great eagerness. Turning now to the nascent parliaments, the newer parliaments, on the other hand, they don't have the luxury of many internal sources of training from which to learn. They mainly depend on training programs provided almost exclusively by external organisations. So in the case of the Pacific Parliament, such as Papua New Guinea, Tonga and Vanuatu, which we studied, for more than a decade, they've relied on programs or either provided or sponsored by CDI, the Centre for Democratic Institutions, or the United Nations Development Programme, sometimes in cooperation. This, in fact, has led to concerns from Pacific Nation parliamentarians that the training programs provided in their parliaments are usually out of context and therefore inappropriate to them. It is because of concerns about the applicability of training programs offered by external providers that there has been a trend in some larger emerging democracies to establish their own parliamentary training bodies. For example, in order to improve the effectiveness of parliamentary training in Vietnam, the National Centre for Elected Representatives was established and has the task of formulating a training program to extend throughout the entire five-year parliamentary term. Similar institutions have been established in Pakistan and South Africa. MPs in nascent democracies also cite other sources of training which are either not used or rarely used in other parliaments. And these include the use of study tours or field trips. And in South Africa, the parliamentarians are actually assisted to undertake relevant university courses. As to what programs and techniques are used, the decisions are usually identified by the Office of the Clerk or the Secretary General, as the case may be, and often in consultation with the political parties. They're mostly designed and delivered based on the perceived knowledge, skills and ability needs that parliamentarians have at a particular time. So, for example, officers of the clerk are responsible for conducting or organising orientation and induction programs for new parliamentarians. However, what is important is that we have found no case in which there has been rigorous training needs assessment undertaken to inform training design and delivery in parliaments, whereas that is common in the public service and in the business sector. So certainly there is feedback from participants in programs, and it's quite common for the providers to make professional observations and assessments of training needs, but without comprehensive training needs assessments, it is difficult to identify potentially relevant training designs and delivery techniques. Now, as I indicated, we collected information on training programs from both officers and parliamentarians. We found that the training programs available in parliaments studied usually differ in nature depending on the intended objective of the training providers or objectives or organisers. For instance, in well-established parliaments, most of the in-house training programs are delivered in lecture format. These programs, some of which can take up to a fortnight, are usually meant to give orientation and induction to new parliamentarians on important matters they need to know about in order to perform their duties efficiently and effectively. However, the majority of parliamentarians shun these types of training programs because, as adults, parliamentarians prefer adult learning techniques which are more experiential than pedagogical. At the other end of the scale, some parliaments do little more than welcome the new parliamentarian and leave him or her to swim or sink alone. This slide then illustrates the range of training methods reported by the people who we interviewed. And as you'll see there, it's very common to provide a handbook or something like that. Even more common to have a staff training and information, a group training and information centre session. But as you'll see from the third column there, those sessions don't necessarily include the opportunities for questions and answers. And after that, you'll see that the training methods used drop away very significantly, and that there is very little use of adult training techniques. The content then brings us to another matter, and not surprisingly, we see that parliamentary procedures, including legislative procedures, rate very highly, as does the use of technology. And certainly in many parliaments that we've studied, this capacity to use technology is really important. But note that in relation to ethical conduct, there is in fact relatively little attention, somewhere around one third involved. That was curious to us, and what we have found is that the officers of some parliaments deliberately eschew and avoid the topic of ethics on the basis that parliamentary officials should not try to tell parliamentarians what is correct behaviour. Also not covered here is the strong interest which many parliamentarians have on policy issues. Now, this is not necessarily to advocate a particular policy, but simply to understand a policy environment. And so we find that training in budget processes, in fact, was pretty highly valued where it did occur, but its occurrence was down there in the other category. Most party-based training programs, such as mentoring, did not rely on lecture-style presentations. They're mostly hands-on in nature and therefore more effective. In South Africa, for example, senior parliamentarians are usually tasked with the responsibility of mentoring newly elected parliamentarians to effectively and efficiently perform their various functions. Now, mentoring, though, does have its problems, for while some parliamentarians can do an excellent job in mentoring, they can also, and I quote, use their experience to spoil aspirations or lead new parliamentarians in the wrong direction, as was explained by one Ethiopian parliamentarian. It follows then that mentoring should be supplemented by other forms of training programs so as to allow new parliamentarians not to be overwhelmed by domineering senior parliamentarians. Party training can also involve some group work. For example, a Canadian parliamentarian stated that his party provides a weekly group work session to consider legislative matters or questions to be posed in the House in the following week. Another type of program offered at the party level in established parliaments is on-the-job training, and this is usually coordinated by the party whips. So, for example, one whip here in Australia pointed out that he had done it for people before. Little tips, like I might approach them and say, now, look, you've got 20 minutes to speak on these bills. Don't go in there with a speech worth 20 minutes. Go in with one 15 minutes worth. If you fall short, no one's going to say, well, they're a fool. They didn't know enough about the subject to talk for 20 minutes. And inevitably, you'll feed off an interjection or something else will pop into your mind, and then you'll go 20 minutes anyway. Again, if you try to go 20 minutes, you'll get distracted and you'll run out of time and you'll miss saying the most important thing you wanted to say, the point you wanted to make. Now, as I indicated, the most prominent types of in-house training available in both established and nascent parliaments are seminars and workshops offered in lecture format. As is the case in established parliaments, parliamentarians in emerging parliaments do not embrace these types of training programs. Just a quote from one South African who had been encouraged, he says, hijacked by one of his colleagues to attend a session. He explained, I sat there, I listened to the trainer. When he was talking, he was doing graphs, economic graphs, and then I looked at my colleague and said, I'm not putting my foot in here again. I'm lost. There is nothing that encourages me to come back here. Well, other forms of training can include self-training methods such as documentation, including handbooks, online materials and DVD stored materials, which can be used for training. Now, although the data from the interviews suggests that the more modern forms are not widely used. Some parliamentarians, both in established and nascent parliaments, have reportedly used this method to reinforce their knowledge, skills and abilities in specific parliamentary issues. Most disappointing finding of the project was the level of satisfaction with the programs undertaken by the people who reported. So you can see there that there's only about 36% of respondents who were satisfied or very satisfied, and that, when you recalculate that as to the number who actually participated, so taking up the did not attend any training, it's still only about 60% were either satisfied or very satisfied. So a disappointing record there again. Well, one of the issues that arose was whether training should be compulsory. Many jurisdictions regard parliamentarians as not being subject to direction and hence not capable of being directed to participate in induction or other programs. However, a significant proportion of jurisdictions do, in fact, require parliamentarians to participate in such programs. And not surprisingly, participation rates are much higher in those cases. So while some parliamentarians agreed that parliamentary training should be mandatory, all felt that it should be sufficiently well designed and delivered as to attract attendance. Now, when it comes to evaluation, there are no rigorous methods used to evaluate training programs in any of the parliaments that we've studied. A few insist on participants completing evaluation forms immediately after the training program. However, these do not allow time for parliamentarians to apply what they have learned from training before assessing the benefits of that training. So a common problem embedded in these programs is that they have not been designed and delivered with the advantage of a thorough trainee needs analysis. And the risk is that, in this case, they will simply repeat the same mistakes in training program after successive training program after successive training program. Another form of learning, of course, is that many parliamentarians, in fact, come into the parliament with some skills which are relevant to their parliamentary career. And in particular, most will have had considerable public speaking and debating experience. And some will have learned through prior service in elected office at local, state or provincial level, so that they may arrive with a well-developed knowledge of some skills and abilities that are relevant, but certainly not all of those relevant to any particular chamber. And there are some occupations, of which law is the obvious example, which are sometimes claimed to be particularly useful to a new Member of Parliament. So whilst very few enter national Parliament fully equipped with all of the skills required to contribute to each of the Parliament's functions, it is important to recognise that each parliamentarian will have unique strengths, weaknesses and training needs. But parliamentarians also learn incidentally. And this is a diagram by a couple of academics, Professors Marsick and Watkins. And I'll just quote the way in which they describe what they've illustrated here. The circle in the centre represents their belief that learning grows out of everyday encounters while living and working in a given context. A new life experience may offer a challenge, a problem to be resolved, or a vision of a future state. The outer circle represents the context within which the experience occurs. The personal, social, business, and cultural context for learning that plays a key role in influencing the way in which people interpret their situation, their choices, the actions they take, and the learning that is affected. The model depicts a progression of meaning-making that, in practice, is often more of an ebb and flow as people begin to make sense of a situation. With each new insight, they may have to go back and question earlier insights. The model is arranged in a circle, but in fact, the steps are neither linear nor necessarily sequential, according to Marsick and Watkins. So whilst it's important to recognise that incidental learning does occur, it is inherently not systematic and may in fact be quite asynchronous with the need to apply certain knowledge, skills and abilities. And, for example, the parliamentarian needs to know and understand the basic standing orders from his or her first sitting rather than learning incidentally sitting in the chamber. Furthermore, incidental learning risks inadvertently learning incomplete or incorrect knowledge, compromising the performance of the parliamentarians and, by extension, the functioning of the parliament. However, when incidental learning does emerge, it can sometimes be built upon by trainers. So, summarising how parliamentarians develop their skills, we see that these range from very brief welcomes and a reliance on incidental learning to substantial programs utilising adult learning techniques, such as those provided by the Australian Senate, and formalised programs provided by dedicated institutions such as the Training Centre for Elected Representatives in Vietnam. So how then should parliamentarians acquire their skills? Now, the findings of the experiences of parliamentarians undertaking training relevant to parliamentary functions leads us to suggestions for assisting them in that development of knowledge, skills and abilities. So we have three major suggestions. Firstly, the content of programs should reflect the institutional interest of each parliament in its members having the capacities to contribute to the effective functioning of the parliament through, firstly, contextual understanding of the parliament's functions, secondly, analytical, deliberative and communicative skills, thirdly, information technology abilities and ethical competence or moral reasoning capacities. The success of parliamentary training is predicated on a comprehensive training needs assessment and an understanding of the common practices in the particular parliament and its unique features. Assessments identifying what parliaments in the particular parliament need to parliamentarians in the particular parliament need to effectively perform their functions in an efficient manner. Rigorous evaluation is an essential corollary. Secondly, participation in training programs should be strongly encouraged. The extent to which the Parliament can make participation mandatory will vary according to domestic conventions and practices. Nonetheless, support and encouragement by party whips is generally accepted by party member parliamentarians as imperative requests. Accordingly, political parties should treat participation in training as if it is a condition of membership of the parliamentary party. However, the benefits must be demonstrated and recognised by parliamentarians if programs are to be a catalyst for them to embrace training. Results from established parliaments suggest that party-based training programs are not only well attended but also perceived by parliamentarians to be more effective than programs delivered by other providers. There is therefore an opportunity amongst donors and external training providers to collaborate with political parties if they want their efforts to improve parliamentary performance to be realised. The trend in nascent democracies to establish training centres for parliamentarians could also be emulated across similar parliaments. This is because local bodies can potentially design culturally and constitutionally sensitive programs and also monitor and evaluate those programs to make them more effective in the future. And thirdly, adult learning techniques should be adopted and applied, having regard to both human resource development theory and practice and responses of parliamentarians who participated in this research. So to conclude, this lecture began from the premise that the induction and training for parliamentarians should serve the interests of good governance through more effective functioning of the institution of Parliament. It has been demonstrated that there are widespread weaknesses in the development of knowledge, skills and abilities that parliamentarians need in order to contribute to the effective functioning of their parliamentary institution. However, the unique features of each parliament dictate that parliamentary training programs must be localised and rigorously evaluated. Without that, there is the risk that flawed training programs will be replicated and recycled. So it's clear that there are three principles then that should inform the development of programs for newly elected and continuing parliamentarians. Firstly, program content should be orientated towards improving the functioning of the parliament. Secondly, high levels of participation are important. And thirdly, the use of adult learning techniques is essential. The governance of representative democracies could be improved by the application of these principles.
Well, thank you very much, Ken. That's certainly a subject that's close to my heart, and I've got lots of questions. If anyone does have a question, I'd invite you to come to the microphone at either side and I'll give you the call. But could I kick off just with the last slide that you put up there? Obviously, a central purpose of training is to improve the functioning of Parliament. Well, how do you measure that? How do you judge what is an improved functioning of Parliament? What are you looking for and who determines it?
Well, as I indicated, Parliament is a sovereign institution within the limitations of its role as prescribed by the Constitution. But within that, it is a sovereign institution which makes its own way. And in our view, the appropriate way to measure the performance of the Parliament is according to the standards which it establishes for itself. That there isn't an independent international or outside institution which can say, look, the Australian Senate's doing this wrongly or should do something in a different way. And I should add that this is an important issue for the Interparliamentary Union, which is one of the partners in this research project. As an association of all of the world's parliaments, they can't get into the business of saying to some, well, look, you're doing things which we regard as unacceptable or incorrect.
I suppose the media play a strong role in judging whether a parliament is being effective or not, but one doesn't always trust the measures that the media likes to use.
Well, I think that you make it a really important point there, and the media, being what it is, tends to report very much on politics and very little on parliament, and I would like to think that we could somehow encourage some greater reflection on the way in which the Parliament is functioning in the way in which the media reports what goes on in politics.
Mm. I suppose another issue is that there's a much greater capacity for people to have direct access to the Parliament through webcasts, live transmission, and to make those judgments for themselves.
Mm. Yes, certainly. And I think one of the... This is getting away from the topic a little bit, but one of the issues for the future is how the parliamentary chambers can improve the interaction which they have with the public in addition to directly through their elected representatives.
Mm. Mm. Would you like to come to the microphone? Oh, yes, please, go ahead.
Dr. Coghill, thank you for a fascinating journey through the learning of members of Parliament. You talk about mentoring and you talk about the role of whips, which presupposes political parties, which, of course, in Australia have a very significant role to play. Has your research found anything about independents and members of, you know, minor parties who don't have the infrastructure to fall back on?
Well, the obvious point is that, yes, they have real difficulties because they don't have the infrastructure of a party to fall back on, to use your terms. That, in my view, makes it all the more important that the Parliament as an institution ensures that assistance and support is available to all members of Parliament, irrespective of party.
Another question up the back. While you make your way to the microphone, I might just pop in another one, and that is, how would one go about designing a training needs analysis for members of parliament? It's not something we've done yet. I'm very keen to do it, but I'd like some tips, please.
Well, look, we'd be very happy to point you in the direction of some of the literature around this, but essentially it would be, in my view, getting together a group of senior senators, in your case, including the president, fairly obviously, to firstly get their consensus view on what are the really important functions that this particular chamber is performing, and going from that, well, what are the knowledge, skills and abilities that each senator should have in order to maximise his or her input to it. So that's a very brief summary of what I would suggest.
Okay. We've got a queue now. Please go ahead.
Thanks, and thanks for the presentation, and thanks, Rosemary, for your questions, because a couple of them were areas that I was interested in too, about how media influences how some of these things are reported, which can affect the motivations of members, but also the expectations of the communities. And that's something that I'm really interested in, particularly in the context of the differences between the findings you've made in developed and emerging parliaments. In other words, in emerging parliaments in countries where potentially parliamentary democracy hasn't been part of the cultural history, some of the ideas about what members' roles are and what the roles of parliament by the community are quite different, and that can really obviously affect what people are demanding from their members, which is also therefore influencing how members are choosing to do their jobs and how they would choose to admit any gap in their existing knowledge. And that becomes quite a powerful motivator, I think. And I'm interested to know whether your studies have taken account of some of those differences almost in the cultural development of approaches to parliamentary democracy. Because where someone doesn't quite know what a parliamentary democracy is supposed to do, they're also not going to necessarily know that the member's job is to do this, effective legislating. It's going to be actually more this, providing immediate infrastructure and resources to the immediate community.
Yes, well, as you may have noticed, five of the countries which we studied intensively were in the Pacific, and that issue was very strongly identified by Abel Kenyondo, who was the PhD candidate who made that his study. And you're absolutely right that there are members of parliament in some of those jurisdictions who are quite content to leave legislating to the experts and just put up their hand to wave it through and in the meantime go back to be a big man in their home constituency and dispense funds in that constituency. Now, one of the really important points which I think Abel made in his research is that this makes the role of the parliamentary staff in those parliaments absolutely crucial. And his argument, which I accept, is that there should be a very strong emphasis on giving those parliamentary staff the skills to help their members of parliament understand what the implications are of the institution of parliament and their functions within it, and that, in fact, they have quite a profound responsibility for the legislation which they're presently just waving through. So in our view, the best suggestion we have, I wouldn't say it's necessarily the solution, but the best suggestion we have is that there should be more emphasis going into support for parliamentary staff, Indigenous parliamentary staff in those parliaments, so that they can play a role in helping the members of parliament understand what their constitutional responsibilities are and how those can be better discharged than they are at the moment.
Go ahead.
I'm particularly interested in three aspects. One is leadership or team, particularly sort of team building. One is communications, how sort of public relations or communicating the message. And thirdly, the issue of running a department, that is sort of what you might call being a CEO, or the issues of governance and management. And I'm really, I'd appreciate if you could tell me where at the moment the parliamentarians get that training And secondly, how could it be improved?
Okay, so you're wanting me to address those three issues for the together. Yep. Okay, so far as leadership is concerned, I suspect that there, well, from my own knowledge as a member of the Australian Labor Party for over 40 years, that it tends to depend on, firstly, the initiative of the individual, and secondly, if the individual is lucky, mentoring from someone who can see that individual's potential and is keen to support it. In communication, there is more done, but it is done by the political parties, in my observation. I'm not aware of a parliament in which there is a significant amount of training in communication skills. However, I would argue that it is a legitimate thing for a parliament to do, that it's in the interests of the parliamentary institution, irrespective of what interest parties may have in it, but it's in the interests of the parliamentary institution for its members to be good communicators, both within the chamber in making decisions and in communicating to the public about the decisions and deliberations of the parliament itself. As to running a department, I assume you're thinking here of ministerial responsibility, and that's something that we have not looked at in this study. It simply wasn't part of this study.
Just repeat the question for them.
Sorry for that, those who didn't hear. The question is, what do I think should be the training available in leadership? Am I right there?
Team building.
In team building and leadership. Again, it seems to me that here's something which, firstly, is almost exclusively, if I'm just reflecting, I think it's almost exclusively something which applies to political party members and not to independents, because independents, by and large, are not part of a team. Although there was a case in which a group of people got elected as the United Independents to a New South Wales local government authority. But to come back to your question, it seems to me that, again, those skills are things which it is appropriate for a parliament to undertake. In cases where there is a training centre for elected representatives, or its equivalent, as in Vietnam, South Africa, and what was the other one, Pakistan, I think it's a more appropriate thing for the training centre for elected representatives to take on rather than parliamentary institution. The reason I say that is that the officers of the parliament might find themselves in a pretty awkward situation if it looks as if they are providing training to the benefit of the opposition, even if they are being even-handed in the way in which they provide it.
And it's really not something we have expertise in providing.
No, and in areas where you don't have expertise, I think it would often be important to bring in people from outside, whether they be private consultants or academics or whatever it may be.
So our last question.
Dr. Coghill, if I read your graphs correctly, it suggested about one-third of incoming or MPs did not attend the training sessions. Has there been any analysis as to whether they were unable to attend or why they voluntarily did not attend?
It's fairly hard to get answers from people about why they didn't do something. And in fact, the figures vary enormously widely. So I quoted the figure from the United Kingdom at the last election, where about one-third of the members were newly elected members, with the exception of three or four who were returning members, but about one-third were new members, and only 19% attended one or more training programs. Now, my view is that the very poor attendance needs to be rectified in two ways. Firstly, the programs have got to be designed both in terms of content and delivery
so as to be attractive. So the word of mouth indicates that, yes, it's something that was worth going to. And secondly, I think there ought to be a lot of work, particularly with the party whips and the party leaders, to, in effect, make it a condition of parliamentary party membership that new members attend and participate in parliamentary induction and training programs. So those are the two responses which I would suggest.
Can I add something to that? And I've been involved in orientation programs for senators since 1993. It's never actually been an issue for us. We've had 100% attendance for every round of training, and I don't know why that is, but there's never been any question of making it compulsory or mandatory. So perhaps we're offering something that was seen as useful.
Well, certainly the limited feedback that I've got suggests that the Senate program is highly regarded by its participants.
Well, I wasn't fishing for that. Let's go to our last question.
I'm not... That's on. Usually when people want a influential career and a well-paid career, they go and do their training first. I'm concerned and confused as to why none of the educational institutions actually offer parliamentary training. As it would be a highly subscribed course, I would have thought, particularly here in Canberra. And you would be able to pick your aspiring politicians from amongst that group, and they would pay for it themselves.
Well, in the master's program that I teach, we have had some possible future MPs. I wouldn't put them in the terms, put in terms of them necessarily being aspiring at the time of their enrolment to be a candidate at the next election. But we have had a small number, but they have found it very difficult to combine formal university education with their other political and other activities. And while they're a candidate, they're doing two things. They're holding down a job of some sort and they're being a candidate. To add university studies on the top of that is not impossible, but it is very, very difficult. I think what would be more appropriate would be short courses, which might extend over days or weeks rather than months. As to why they haven't been offered to date, my experience since moving to the university sector is that it is fairly inflexible, and the funding regime and everything else that applies to universities makes it much more attractive to teach a formal degree course than it does to run short courses. And
I suppose what I was getting at was actually undergraduate, as part of an undergraduate course, there would be a high degree of people who would be interested in understanding about the parliamentary processes and those sorts of things, that you could start at that point. Most MPs train in law. There's no reason that some parliamentary training couldn't be offered. A lot of our politicians are actually the sons of or daughters of politicians.
Yeah.
Yes,
just on your point about the law, in fact, most people are surprised when they actually look at the figures at what a small proportion of members of parliament do have a law degree. It's not a tiny proportion, but it's far from a majority. So I think that's something I'd just like to set the record straight on. Certainly many of the young people I meet who have an interest in a possible political career, not necessarily in elected office, but maybe working in politics, take a course that includes politics, an undergraduate degree that includes politics, and very often foreign affairs, international affairs, something like that. So that's pretty much my observation of the people that I meet now who want to get into a political career in one form or another.
Well, sadly, our time is up. We're going to have to wrap it up there. But thank you all for coming today to a very interesting lecture. certainly given me heaps of food for thought. And it's a great point to end our year's offerings on. So thank you all for coming and look forward to seeing you next year. Please join me in thanking Ken Cogle for a great lecture.